Welcome to That Triathlon Show, the podcast presented by Scientific Triathlon and hosted by me, Michael Eriksson. Today's guest is Paul Booth, a performance nutritionist and exercise physiologist who works with elite athletes and teams in ultra-endurance sports, including the Salomon International team. He is currently also working on a PhD at the Leeds Beckett University on fueling and performance in ultra-endurance exercise. And at the UTMB in 2025, he was the nutritionist and physiologist behind both the female and male race winners, Ruth Croft and Tom Evans. Paul, welcome to the show. How are you doing?
Yeah, good, thanks. Thank you for inviting me.
It's great to have you. I want to start with something a little bit different, which is there something that you believe to be true about nutrition, physiology, or training that listeners might not expect?
I'd say the big thing is that what I believe to be true is that most of the other stuff isn't true. So again, like what I'm doing in terms of some of the physiology and the science, a lot of the things that led me there was simply a lot of the notions around it, which like everything kind of comes from a trend or anecdotal. And actually, like a lot of things we're talking about today, particularly in terms of like carbohydrate oxidation, haven't actually been supported fully by the science. So again, like for me, it's thinking about the evidence base and like what someone might claim that works. When we start to backtrack and start to look at the science around that, we'll quite often see the opposite. So again, it's quite a broad question. I hope I've answered it okay.
I don't know. If you're more specific, are you saying that you believe that people are taking too much carbohydrates, if I read between the lines a bit?
Specifically, I didn't really kind of want to say it quite like that. Just because the paper I had out a couple of weeks ago, which outlined the science behind kind of carbohydrate, ultra high carbohydrate intakes, let's say above 90 grams an hour, rage baited quite a few people, where like there seems to be quite a shift that went from sort of 2012 to 2020, which was the rise of keto, let's say. And again, that was kind of roundly dismissed, but now we've gone completely the polar opposite and we're in this sort of ultra high carb period. And there's just simply no data at all to support that. I kind of talk about this quite open, but now, like the fact is, I mean, I'm sort of on the fence and I've worked for a number of years trying to essentially prove that like high carb really does work. But so far, I've not been able to find any evidence of that. And there is no evidence in the science. So I'm starting to get branded like a low carb guy. And actually, I'm just a 90 carb guy. Like a few years ago, that was really high carbs. And now it's somewhere sitting on the fence in the middle. So for me, yeah, I'm kind of guided by the science. But I think, you know, in a nutshell, people believe taking more and more carbohydrates is going to make them improve performance more and more. And it's not. There's certainly a ceiling to that. And I think that ceiling is a lot lower than most people realize.
It's funny you call yourself a 90 gram carb guy. I was interviewed on a podcast, I think it was a couple of months ago, and I'm not a nutritionist, so I don't have the credibility that you do to speak on those topics. But I coach enough people and I support them with their nutrition plans for races, obviously. So just in my humble anecdotal experience as a coach, that's what, for most age groupers, that's where I've kind of landed, that 90 grams works really well. So that was my answer to a question that they had on nutrition I said that, well, I'm not an ultra high carb guy. I'm a 90 gram carb guy. I think paraphrasing a bit, but that's basically what I said. That being said, I think your new study, must have been written around the same time. There was a new study that I have on my second screen here that just came out, I think, a week or a couple of weeks ago. From some of your colleagues, not colleagues exactly, but at the Liverpool John Moores University, which was graded carbohydrate ingestion up to 120 grams per hour attenuates the reduction in critical power following 3 hours of moderate intensity exercise in a dose-dependent manner. So that one, they did, without going into the details, they did show 120 grams as being beneficial on over 90 grams per hour. in the metrics that the outcome metrics that they were investigating on the bike, of course. But have you looked at that study? Have you seen it?
Yeah, I did. I've read that study, and actually, I'm presenting at the European College of Sports Science conference next week, and on the same panel as those guys. I think with that study, the elephant in the room is that they went from 60, which for me is underfueling, to 120, which could be potentially overfueling. But in the 120, like people will be fueled efficiently in that at some point. So whereas the 90, like the current recommendations are still 90 grams. There's nowhere where it says you should take 120 grams apart from anecdotally or on podcasts or coaches or people kind of pushing that agenda. Like in the scientific literature, none of it's there. So it feels odd that you double the carbohydrate intake from 60 to 120. And again, sure, you're going to find differences there because it's such a huge jump up. I think if you're going to do it properly, you know, you've got to look at like 90 in there. And again, I always wonder why 60, because 60 is underfueling. So it's like, why would I send an elite athlete out underfueled? I would never do that. So 60 then becomes an arbitrary number. So for me, it's always, I think, you know, we've got to base everything around that 90 number because we've got plenty of research actually that shows that like that's potentially the optimal dose so far until the science comes to change that again, which it might. There's certainly potential, but it's just not there yet.
Yeah. Well, that's actually a very, very astute note. I must say I haven't read the study yet. I have it on my reading list, but yeah, I didn't even realize that they didn't. I just assumed that they tested 90 grams as a condition. So that's my mistake. But that is, like you say, a big elephant in the room.
Because with the previous LJMU study that came out last year on elite marathon runners, they did test 60, 90 and 120. But actually, there was no significant difference between 60 and 90 and 90 and 120. There was between 60 and 120, but again, that's doubling the dose. So we'd expect to see that. But the fact that there was no difference between 90 and 120, I just wonder if they put 90 in this study, would we have seen the same? The fact that there's no difference in terms of performance or physiological outcomes between those doses, those 30 gram doses.
Yeah. I am going to play the devil's advocate here a little bit, even though I called myself a 90 gram per hour guy, because I guess if I had to lean one way or the other, I would rather lean slightly more than slightly less in the context of the athletes that I work with anyway. But a couple of questions on that, two questions mainly. Do you think that there is an exception to sort of the 90 gram being optimal and potentially higher being better? We're talking about big outputs, for example, people doing 300 plus watts for whether it's a half or a full distance Ironman, for example. So they're burning through a lot of energy, a lot of carbohydrates. And secondly, you mentioned a lot about like the science not being there, which I think is very fair. But do you think that this might be one of those cases, which we've had a lot of, that science is not always leading the way? Sometimes science is just catching up on what is actually working and what is proving to work in the real world.
Yeah, it's a good point. But I do think that there's enough science around metabolism and the physiology of like around carbohydrate absorption to tell us that there's a ceiling to that. And as much as people like believe that the higher intensity, the more carbohydrates they're going to use is true. Like, it's not necessary that you're just going to increase exogenous carbohydrate oxidation in a linear fashion along with that, because there's going to be certain blockages along the way. And we know that, like, the muscles, when in intravenous studies, like, the muscles have been seen to oxidize anywhere between sort of 2 and 3 grams a minute. So, what we're looking at, 120 to 180 grams an hour easily. But again, when we take that step back and look at the rest of the body, you know, like we're looking at the gut lumen and those carbohydrate transporters, which like there's only so much we can get through there. Like there's only so much before they become saturated. So that's always going to be the ceiling to that. And people kind of keep saying, oh, well, if I train more, if I'm elite, then surely that will go up. I'll get more of those transporters. And I've tested a lot of like world-class athletes and I've just not seen that. I mean, I've seen people whose oxidation rates are higher than what some of the literature would suggest or what some of the averages are. But then again, I've seen some which are lower as well. So we can't get that balance. So if I was to put in 200 grams of carbohydrates, like there's two questions. Like one, like most of that will be sitting around my gut. There's no way that that's going to all get oxidized. And secondly, like depending on what the demands of a sport are, that I'm probably not going to need that much either. So again, it's like people kind of keep adding numbers to it more and more and more, but like it's not really going anywhere. The only place it's going is creating more gastrointestinal distress. And again, I think the comparison that people are making as well, again, going right back to what I was saying about the start, about truths and untruths. Again, this all kind of comes from a lot of social media and a lot of anecdotal evidence. And people say more carbs are better. And in many respects, that is true. But as I say, there's a limit to that. But are people comparing, you know, 120 or 140 grams an hour to 90, let's say? Or actually, have people gone from being in this low carb era where we're trying to be fat, like trying to oxidize fat more? So we're going out and doing all our sessions on like next to nothing, essentially, or fasted. And then we're not performing very well. Now we're in a high carb era and we're going really high carbs and we're performing really well. We're going, oh, it's because we're taking 120 grams. It might just be the fact that we're just taking carbs, or it might just be we're taking more than 60 grams of carbs, let's say. So the fact is, it's not always going to be 120, 140, 160. And it's unlikely to be that. It's just the fact that we're probably fueling more efficiently. And somewhere along the way, we're meeting our optimal fueling needs, and we're simply able to tolerate the rest of those carbohydrates which are hanging around our gut, or we throw up just after the finish line, like see with a lot of people, particularly at an Ironman triathlon.
Or on the run course.
Yeah, exactly.
No, that's a great answer. Can you explain for listeners what the rate limiting step, physiologically speaking, would be in terms of how much carbohydrate it's reasonable to expect that would be beneficial?
Yeah, so like with glucose then, which for most people taking gels and sports drinks, most of the time glucose now would be malted dextrin. So you'd see malted dextrin and then fructose. Ideally, that would be at 1:0.8 ratio. So one part glucose to 0.8 ratio of fructose. Like glucose stroke maltodextrin uses SGLT1 transporter, and that saturates at roughly about 1.1, 1.2 grams a minute. So realistically, we're looking at somewhere between 60 and 70 grams an hour. Only a couple of weeks ago, I had two world-class athletes in the lab, and one of those athletes, like they were completely saturated, peaked when we look at oxidation rates at about 58-ish. And then the other athlete was actually pretty high at 70. One was a female athlete and one was a male athlete. So there could well be a discrepancy between, and there was a paper by EJAS, I think last year or the year before, that looked at this. There could well be changes in overall size and weight. So one of those athletes was 55 kilos, the other was 75. And the larger athlete actually oxidized the 70, and the smaller athlete, like the 58, still really, really good. So we know that that's going to be saturated at that point. So that was just glucose only. So now we could start to add fructose to that. So we might put on a little bit more. So for instance, if we were going to, if we were using that 1:0.8 ratio and like that athlete who could oxidize to 70 grams was taking in carbs of this, then that would work out actually, potentially the optimal rate for that athlete could be 126 grams an hour. So that would be about 70 grams of glucose stroke fructose, stroke maltodextrin, and then add in 56 grams of fructose to that as well. So that 1:0.8 ratio. So the other athlete, so for those athletes who are more on sort of 60, then actually that works out like 60 grams of glucose and then 48 grams of fructose, which works out 108 grams of carbs in total. And that completely matches the numbers which were given out in a paper like a decade ago now by David Rowlands, who looked at like what that perfect ratio was and how many, and he came up with this number of 108. So again, like, so we're still going in high carb, and we're actually going above those recommendations. And for these athletes, that's where their carbohydrate oxidation rates are going to peak. But at the same time, a big question is, do those athletes need that much? And one of those athletes I've worked with in the past, and they've, you know, they've won some major international competitions on 90 and 80 grams an hour.
How long competitions were those?
Like major ultra marathons, so things like UTMB, so 20, 21 hours.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that was going to be my follow-up question then. So you might be able to estimate your theoretical maximum, which seems to be, depending on the size a bit, but it could be around at 120. But how do you, as an individual athlete, especially if you don't have the support of somebody like yourself, but the listener of this podcast who has to do that on their own, even without a coach potentially, how did they go about figuring out how much they should consume? Should they just go straight up 90 grams is a good sort of sweet spot? Or what are the factors that might lead them to go down or up a little bit from that, let's say, starting point?
Yeah, well, I would say that like 60 gram figure in terms of that SGLT1 saturation, and then the fructose saturation is GLUT5, but we're not quite sure what the saturation point of that is. Like when that's being measured on its own, it's about 30 grams. But actually, when you combine fructose and glucose together, that fructose oxidation rate will go up. So they work in synergy with each other really well. So it doesn't really make any difference to glucose, but it does to fructose. So this is where these ratios are really important. Getting back to your question of how would an athlete be able to figure this out, like without the kind of like the sort of isotope tracing that we would do in the lab. I'd say the number one thing is think about what kind of athlete you're going to be and what you need. What do you think those demands are? If you're going to be sort of back of a pack and you're just kind of going to go slow and you're just trying to enjoy your day, then you probably don't need a hell of a lot. Or if you're doing an ultra, and let's say it's a 50K ultra, where it's going to take you, you know, and there's a 1500 meters of climbing, in, let's say a trail. It's going to
Can we take an Ironman as the context for this episode? Just because that's still the main listener base of the episode is triathletes. I will ask some questions about ultras, but if I think you've done triathlons and Ironmans as well. So if that's okay, let's go with Ironman as the context for the examples.
Yeah. So what do you think's like a sort of mid pack Ironman time? Would you say
12 hours? 12. Yeah. I think the median time might be around 13 to 14, but I would say 12 hours is sort of a typical mid pack time.
Yeah, so if we went to that 12 to 14 hours, then I would try and really start to think about anything lower than that, then you're probably not going to need that many more carbs because you've just not got that intensity there to need it. Round about that, you know, I would probably just aim for 90 grams an hour, purely because it's just going to be a lot easier on the gut and it's just something safe. Ideally, though, I would more go for that 1 to 0.8 ratio that we've said rather than the general sort of 2 to 1 ratio that we often see in the literature or sold as sports products. And again, like most companies do a 1 to 0.8 gel and drink now, or you can make your own, which we can talk about a little bit later on. But yeah, that's probably a good starting point. A lot of people will still get like gut issues from that because that's still really high for a lot of people. So gut training is going to be absolutely key to that, simply to be able to tolerate that, particularly like over 12 to 14 hours. That's still a long amount of time where you're going to try and take all these carbohydrates on per hour, particularly after the swim. So again, for an Ironman, it might be skewed a little bit more, again, where you might certainly take more on the bike and then a little bit more, obviously, during the marathon. Some people just seem to take on like high doses every hour. But if you look at the sort of the history of triathlon, like the first the first time I actually saw people taking up to 120 grams was in some literature from two international Ironman events. I think it was Kona and Ironman Germany from 2009. And it showed some of the highest performance there on average were taking 120 grams an hour. But when you dig in, what you saw is actually they were overfueling on the bike, which sort of drip feeds the run. So again, you're putting excess carbohydrates in, it's slowing gastric emptying. So actually, you know, you're getting a little bit more of a feed through the run. So you're not taking on as high on the run. Again, Matt, I always thought that's the angle people would go on, particularly from triathlon for high carbs. Whereas now it seems people are doing that on the bike and on the run as well. Anyone above 12 hours, yeah, I'd start to maybe think potentially going up higher, particularly this kind of 108, 110 grams. But again, there's still no literature that supports that. And the literature that is there that looks at doses higher has actually found a negative correlation with performance. So some of those doses where they've gone 100, 110, 120, actually, rather than we see an improvement in performance, that's actually starting to drop. And again, the modality for those is quite often cycling. So there is a crossover, certainly in terms of Ironman there. So again, like for me, being sort of conservative and playing it safe, I would still go for that 90 to 100. And then occasionally I might go up to 110 if I know there's going to be a period of time where the athletes might not be able to eat as much. So on an Ironman bike course, I might start off a little bit easier and then bring it up the last couple of hours on the bike just to help drip feed the run a little bit more.
Thank you to Precision Fuel Hydration for supporting today's episode. Precision Fuel Hydration make fueling and hydration simple. Their gels, like the PF30, PF90, and the caffeinated PF30, are easy to consume due to the pleasant but not overpowering flavor. And they are very easy to count carbs with because they have 30 grams or 90 grams of carbs, not 23 or 22 and a half, which I've had lots of gels with those amounts in the past. And that's not easy at kilometer 30 of an Ironman. They also have carb only and carb plus electrolyte drink mixes, plus electrolyte tablets and sachets of different strengths so you can match them to your sweat sodium concentration. And they have tons of science-based articles in their knowledge hub on the website, including an amazing case study database where you can filter for things like event type, heat and humidity, and the sweat sodium concentration of the athlete and lots more, which is incredibly valuable because you can basically try to match your athlete type and your race type. And you can see what has worked for world-class athletes, including athletes winning world championships over the Ironman and Ironman 70.3. So visit precisionfuelhydration.com and use the code TTS2026 to get 15% off from your first order. Yeah, that makes sense. Let me just confirm what you said, because I'm not sure I got it right, that you said if somebody's slower than 12 hours, you said that you would go lower than that. Than that 90 grams per hour potentially, but then you said at the end, I thought you said if they are above 12 hours. So did I interpret that?
Sorry, I meant like faster than 12.
Faster. Hours. Okay. Yeah. Okay. Got it. That makes sense. I think that's the common practice for sure to take a bit more on the bike and then you're able to do a bit less on the run. And I do think people still do that. Maybe some are able to go quite high on the run, but by and large, I think it's like really the bike where the people that are doing the really high carb stuff, it's always the bike you hear about. You don't necessarily hear the numbers from the run as much. Like I'm thinking about Cam Wirth claimed 180 grams per hour on the bike when he set the Ironman bike course record or 162, yeah. Whatever it is, in that range. But yeah, you don't really... here, and it didn't really help him to have he had a decent race for him, but not like nothing out of the ordinary for on the run or in the overall finishing ranks on the race. But that's beside the point. Are there any moderating factors that athletes should consider other than the relative intensity that you're working at, or the absolute intensity, I should say, so absolute and relative, to be fair. For example, things like environmental conditions and even if you're racing at altitude, or is that going to impact your carbohydrate consumption?
Yeah, well, that's a really good point. And all these things, even intensity, rather than increase carbohydrate oxidation, actually it drives it down. So again, like intensity, when like, again, some research, when we see athletes performing above 75% or around about 75% VO2 max, actually, like it can reduce the amount of carbohydrates which are oxidized because it reduces absorption. Because obviously a lot of the blood is moving away from your gut and going to the working muscles and to the skin to sweat. So that rate of carbohydrate absorption actually gets reduced at higher intensity. So people are putting in more, but actually like the opposite might be happening in terms of that's going down. The same altitude as well. So we've been doing some altitude work in the environmental chambers recently at the university. And what we'll quite often see there is you get people in and actually we'll try and acclimatize them. But like the amount of carbohydrates they're able to oxidize at sea level and at altitude always tends to drop at altitude. So again, rather than fill someone up with carbs there, we're trying to work more on ensuring that the carbohydrate loading properly, you know, they're not skimping on that, decent breakfast, and then really kind of fine tuning in what they're going to take during any, you know, anything at altitude, particularly higher altitude when we start to get over 3,000 meters. It's exactly the same thing for heat as well. So what we quite often see is in the heat, that absorption rate will go down unless someone is acclimatized to that heat. So we've done lots of heat training and we're used to that. Then actually that sort of puts things back to normal. But again, even with the heat, like the increase in gastrointestinal distress, increase in core temperature, gut damage is all going to affect that carbohydrate absorption as well. So it could be that, like in terms of that GI distress, like you think, oh, it's hot or I'm at altitude, I've got to feed more. You could just be pouring petrol onto the fire, basically. Like it, you know, it might be making things worse rather than making things better.
Yeah, yeah. And 75% of VO2 max, just to put that in terms that people are more familiar with, I guess you could call that kind of like a zone 3 level intensity in a 5-zone model. So it's not quite threshold, but it's between the two thresholds somewhere.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, for some lucky people, it's round about their LT1, but for the rest of us, it's definitely in zone 3.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. And gut training, you mentioned that. How does one go about that?
Yeah. I mean, there's not a hell of a lot of complex science behind it. It's simply go out and take a lot of carbs during training. But I mean, there's one caveat with that as well. A lot of this actually reflects like gastric emptying. So you're trying to train like your tolerance to taking on board like carbohydrates and food. And there's some literature says actually you can gut train on anything. So like obviously taking carbs on is easy, but you can train on like protein, on fat, and just basically foods. You're just trying to build up that tolerance to foods while you're performing exercise. But I think what's really important there is fluid intake as well. So you're almost trying to take on fluid to sort of stretch and expand the gut a little bit, the stomach. So again, like some people will take on lots of carbs but neglect the fluid. And actually, you almost want to like drink quite a lot, like not overdrink, particularly on something that's longer, but try and top up as much as possible to increase gastric emptying. So some of the research suggests that like the higher the volume in your gut, the more it drives gastric emptying. And they've seen that like that gut volume go up to about 1.2 liters. So you think, okay, reasonably, I could probably fit about 1.2 liters of fluid in there before it creates any problems. So if you're trying to aim for, let's say, like a liter an hour, then I'll try and drink like, you know, every 5 or every 10 minutes just to try and keep that full. So you're emptying your gut out as much as possible. And again, that works really well for gut training. With gut training as well, I would be prepared for the worst. So like, it's not going to happen overnight. So like with any carbohydrate intake, with any gut training, like any performance, start with what you feel comfortable with. So if you feel uncomfortable with 90 grams an hour, don't go there. Start with 40 or 50. build it up to 60, build it up to 80, build it up to 90, and then build it up to 120 and beyond if you so think. But if your end target is 90 grams an hour, then actually, you know, we would want like a 20% buffer above that. So if you were to go out and do a long run or a long bike session, ideally, we'd want you to be able to sit comfortably at 110 grams an hour. Or if your target was 120 grams, then ideally, we would want you to go out and sit comfortably at anywhere between 140 and 150 grams an hour. You're not going to take that much in the race, but some really solid research suggests if you go 20% over, you know, you've created that buffer in training. When you go into competition, you've got that little bit of a room for maneuver there. So again, it's just improving that tolerance to the gut to whatever you're taking on. And then you're going to modify that in terms of what you think your hydration needs are going to be, the environmental conditions on the day, anything else that goes around that, anxiety, nerves, things like that.
And how often would you practice gut training, and for what sort of a period leading into the race where you want to actually put it in practice?
Yeah, it depends on the individual. So again, you can do really solid gut training, and it's shown to make like a marked improvement to athletes within 2 weeks. So that's always an option for me. I tend to start, depends on the athlete, but anywhere between 8 and 12 weeks out. And it's more because like in that time, you know, we can build that up gradually. And athletes can start to, you know, experiment with different forms of nutrition. So different drinks, different gels, different bars, whatever that may be. So they can start to dial in the race plan during that. So again, I always think 8 weeks is pretty good, because at the same time, like, we are going to go in heavy with the carbs, and there's certainly going to be situations where it's going to bring on GI distress. Like, you might be sick, you might need the toilet, you might get cramping, you might get bloating. What we don't want, particularly in that important training block before a race, is to disrupt that with too much GI distress. So on one hand, we're trying to train the gut. On the other, we're trying to train the body, so we're in the best shape as possible when we get to that race. If those gut issues interfere with that, then actually you're not going to be on your best when it comes to race day. So we need to factor in how to put this, how to wrap this training around that training. So for me, it's always start off with recovery runs and easy runs or easy bike rides, things like that. And then when you start getting comfortable, build it up, start to put that into your long run, long ride brick sessions, for example, and then start to work on it then from there. After a few weeks, what people will probably notice is actually those longer sessions are starting to improve even more, because they're starting to fuel more effectively without even trying. And that's all through that gut training. So again, it's kind of working on working and working on it to build up that tolerance, but also to give somebody that confidence that they know that they're able to take that on board for X amount of hours and not have any gut distress from it.
Yeah, that's brilliant. That's really good. The point you mentioned earlier about the fluid and gastric emptying, that was really interesting, because anecdotally, I've definitely seen that to be the case, that you tend to, you minimize the risk of any GI issues and you maximize your chances of having a good day. You can take on a decent amount of carbs when you also make sure that you you take on enough fluid, I should say, not fuel. But I never knew about that fact that you actually increased gastric emptying with that fluid in the gut. So that's really interesting. So let's move into discussing fluid intake then. Other than that fact that you mentioned, there's also other factors to consider, like you're losing fluid through your sweat and so on. So can you discuss fluid in general, give an overview, and we can move into then how to determine exactly how much fluid to consume and what factors will impact that?
Yeah, so kind of segueing from that last point in terms of gastric emptying and fluid, how that relates to carbs as well. I'm sort of thinking about this because I heard on a different podcast this morning that someone said that, they did much better on a certain race because they increased the amount of electrolytes we took on. So it increased gastric emptying, which is wrong. So gastric emptying is also controlled by essentially the amount of energy you've got in your gut. So the amount of carbs you take on. So the amount of carbohydrates, like high carbohydrates, is going to slow down that gastric emptying as well. Electrolytes, for example, are not going to make any difference to that at all. So that's, I think, one important factor in there. And the fact that all these things fit into each other. So hydration and carbohydrates, you know, once we reach the gut, you know, it's going to change and it's going to affect some of that gut motility, which again could have knock-on effects in terms of performance, but also in particular GI distress. And I keep talking about GI distress because there's a very fine balance between optimal fueling and like getting really bad guts. Sometimes I think it's a little bit better to potentially be safe and conservative, underfuel a little bit, rather than risking all your race and getting a DNF because you need to be sick or even worse than that, which again, see quite often. So going back to hydration and linking it into gut issues, a few years ago where I worked with clients, like a lot of people come to me and say, I get gut issues during triathlon or during this or during a marathon or during an ultra. What should I do about it? So we would spend quite a long time at looking at the exact foods that they eat and the raised nutrition, and we would do lots of experimentation. We'd dial everything in and then we would do hydration. And after a while, I skipped it around. So I went hydration first and it resolved 70% of the problems there and then. And what I realized is most of the time, it wasn't actually like an issue with taking on carbs or food. It was an issue with hydration, because all of a sudden what happens is if you're starting to underhydrate, then we've got the gut, like it's carrying oxygen to work to like to the gut lining. Yeah. If you're starting to run or swim or ride, then more of that blood is going to get shunted away from the gut to the working muscles. And then it's going to go to the skin to sweat as well. In hot conditions or at conditions where you work in more of an intense pace, then obviously you're going to, more of that's going to go to the skin and you're going to sweat even more. So all of a sudden, we've got blood moving away from the gut. So that's going to start to create some damage there, and that's going to slow down what the gut's capable of, so to speak. But also, we've got that high sweat rate, so we're going to have even less blood to go around. The heart's going to work even harder. So all of a sudden, like the tight junctions in the gut, that will start to get inflammation and they'll start to break down. So that's where a lot of the GI issues actually start. So you'll like get like small particles of bacteria getting through and get into the blood. So those feelings of nausea usually come through that. And again, like you'll get kind of nausea or being sick from usually from two different things. It's either that kind of breakdown of the gut, which is the kind of a classic symptom that you would see at that sort of 6 to 8 hour mark, or you'll simply get that, let's call it projectile vomiting, where someone all of a sudden just throws up out of the blue without even those feelings of nausea before. And that's simply just the fact that the gut's too full and your gut has just shoved on the brake on a brake and it's gone, look, there's too much energy coming through. I'm putting the brake on, it all backs up, and then obviously it comes out.
When you say it's too full by what? What is it that, is it just your anything, like, but fluid, carbs, or water?
Yeah, yeah, exactly. So a lot of the time it's just taking on too many carbs. So unoxidized carbohydrates floating around in there. But also for a lot of people, it's too much fluid as well. So again, this is why I think it's really important to train the gut on fluid, because I'll get people in the lab and they'll get gut issues. And it's not necessarily through the carbs we're giving them, it's the amount of fluid. So they might be drinking like 600 mil an hour, but like they'll say to me, oh, in a race, I never drink this much. So actually that's quite a lot for that person. So again, it's really important to make sure you're fully hydrated on that race for your gut integrity and for your performance. So it's really kind of worth going in. And obviously we don't want to overdrink because that's going to cause hyponatremia in the long run. But we want to make sure we kind of dial in on what our fluid needs would be. There's a simple way of doing that. that every athlete can do at home, like DIY method, which is just weighing yourself. So I get all my athletes to do that, whether they're elite or amateur, where if you're going for a ride or you're going for a run, get your weighing scales, put them by the door that you would leave on a solid surface, go out and run or ride for 20 minutes where you get a good sweat up, jump back in, jump on the scales, strip down as much as possible so you've got no sweat retention in any of your clothing, and then go out and do the session. Ideally, do the session at 1 or 2 hours, and then record any gels that you take, any bars, any fluid you take on. If you've got to stop and urinate, usually that's going to be about 300 mil. I read somewhere, I'm sure it's something like 200, the average was 270 mil for men and 300 mil for women. I'm not quite sure on those figures though. But yeah, I wouldn't say collect it. If you want to do it right, collect your urine, but nobody wants to like ride home with a bottle of piss in the back pocket. So again, like I always think that 20 minutes pre where you're getting that sweat is a good time to work anything out if you do need the toilet. So go in that time and then try and keep that hour or 2 hours as clean as possible. And then when you get back, weigh yourself. And whatever that weight is, once you've subtracted the fluid from that and the gels, then that will be your overall fluid loss. So let's say you left the house, you rode for 1 hour and you were 70 kilos and you got back and you were 69 kilos. You didn't take any drink or gels on. Then we know that your sweat rate at that intensity is going to be 1 liter an hour. But again, like that's always going to change because it depends on what the intensity was, what the humidity was, what the environmental conditions were on the day, wind speed, things like that. So rather than doing it once, create a spreadsheet, like Google Sheet, whatever it may be, just put as much data on there as possible. So every time you go out, like for a run or a ride, look on your phone at what the temperature is, things like that, time of day, and create a data set. So when you get to a race, you go, oh, okay, well, on such and such a date, this is what it was, and these were exact same conditions. So that'll give you a little bit of a ballpark figure, and then you can start to play around with that a little bit and see how you feel as well. Because ultimately, we don't want to be dropping more than sort of 2 or 3% body weight, because this is, for some people, quite that low limit is when I start to see some of those gut issues. But also, that's the point when performance will decrease as well.
Can the data that you collect in this way be extrapolated to the end of a, or even the middle part of a longer ultra endurance event? For example, if you know that you're running at a certain pace at hour 12 of an Ironman marathon, is that sweat rate going to be the same in the same, if we assume the same environmental conditions, as you going out for a jog and you're measuring sort of the first hour? Or except that 20-minute pre-period, but you know, you're measuring the early part of a run, and maybe it's the same intensity, but you haven't done the 11 hours prior. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, no, it's a good question. And you're right, like your sweat rate is going to change all the way through. And the fact is, if you're dehydrated, then your sweat rate is going to change. Then, like your body will try and retain more of that fluid. So your sweat rate will actually drop during that time. So again, that first hour might be different than the last hour. And then intensity is going to change across that time as well. And then, yeah, like I've seen like long races, which like ultras, for example, where they'll go from the daytime to the nighttime. And in the day, it could be 30 degrees and then it could drop to almost zero overnight. So the needs are going to be really different then. So again, it's having that large amount of personal data as much as possible that you can recall and plan into your strategies, but also being able to adjust to that and understand what your tolerance, what your limits are, and what you found comfortable in training as well.
How, if you have a higher sweat rate, let's say, especially if you're doing some races now in summertime, in hot weather, whether it's a triathlon or an ultra race or something like that, how much of your sweat losses should you try to replace if you're well above 1 liter an hour at the at your race intensity in racing conditions?
Yeah, so you're looking at probably about, I'm just trying to figure it out. So basically, you want to keep within that 2 or 3% loss in body weight all the way through. So you're not replacing 100% per hour, but I mean, this is one of the difficult things. So the longer it becomes, the more difficult it becomes, because obviously, like, we're using a finer margin to try and keep within that quite small percentage. Like in a marathon, it's really easy actually. And we can kind of target maybe a 2 or 3% loss by the end. Again, in an Ironman, I would still say, let's target that 2 or 3% loss, but that might be gradual all the way through. So trying to get that really sort of dialed in it's quite granulated. So again, it's something you might test out and then just go a little bit less on. So for most people, like, you've got to think about those tolerance levels. So let's take for granted that you've done some gut training around like your hydration needs all the way through that period. Like, for a lot of people, like, once you start getting over a liter an hour, it becomes quite uncomfortable for the gut. So that might well be the ceiling for most people already before, without even understanding what those sweat rates are. And for a lot of people, we can fairly assume that if the temperature's high, you know, over in the summer season, then sweat rates are going to be high. If someone, you know, it's someone at the front of the pack, then yeah, certainly those sweat rates are going to be really high. So again, it's more kind of going off feel for that. We've also got to think about, you know, those gastric emptying rates. Like, we know they're going to top out roughly about 1.2 liters an hour-ish. So even if we're, like, let's say we're sweating 3 liters an hour, which for some people we do, then there's no way we're going to be able to replace all that. So in many respects, like, the figures that we might see, it's not always going to be possible in the real world to kind of put that much back. So we've got to think, okay, what can we live with in terms of, you know, what those overall body weight losses are?
Yeah, this is what I was thinking about the as a conundrum with those really high sweat rates. Like you said, I've heard of athletes with that 3 liter per hour sweat rate. I've never worked with an athlete with that high a sweat rate personally, but I've heard of actually of a famous example. I think that we talked about this on the podcast with Richard Laidlaw, so Sam Laidlaw's father and coach, and I think he said here on this podcast that he consumed 3 liters an hour in like a hot Ironman in Lanzarote, I think, and he needed that because his sweat rate was just so high. But then, like you said, if there's a limit to gastric emptying that is about 1.2 liters an hour, even if you account for maybe yeah, he's a bigger guy, might be a bit bigger for him, but where do you, yeah, which one do you pick? Do you pick the gastric emptying as the limiter, or do you pick that, well, actually you need to try to limit your fluid loss and stay within those ideally 2 to 3% body weight loss?
Yeah, it's a good question. Purely because, and this is where that dilemma is, because again, I see people taking on more than that in races and being absolutely fine. So again, like, I just wonder, again, that's all going to get processed, but like, is it to do with the fact that he's able to take on more? You know, is it through that gut training potentially? Or is there another factor in there? I'm not totally sure what the answer is to that. I would like to know, because again, like, it would make a pretty big difference. Like, both in terms of like how someone's gut would respond, but also obviously in terms of that thermoregulation.
Yeah, absolutely. What about electrolytes?
Yeah, so electrolytes, pretty controversial topic. Me personally, like, just think a lot of it's marketing hype. I'm not saying electrolytes aren't important, but from what I see, just the levels that people are taking are just not needed. So again, I'd say the best work around this and on hydration in general is like through the work of more recently, Alan McCubbin from Monash University in Australia. So Alan McCubbin did some really good work on electrolytes. And he got people in a lab and looked at them. And I think that was over 5 hours. And he realized that basically anything under 5 hours just didn't need electrolytes unless it was certain outliers and in certain circumstances. Again, we don't really know. That was up to 5 hours. So beyond 5 hours, we're not too sure. So for me, I would say certainly take electrolytes beyond that. But these super high doses are probably not needed. So again, Alan created a really good formula to understand what your electrolyte needs are. And again, when we start to look at those, like people are replacing much more than they need. And again,
what is the formula?
Oh, I'm not too sure.
What does it take in? What goes into it?
So with that, essentially that formula, so it's a mathematical equation where you essentially do a sweat sodium test, and then you kind of plug that into the data. He's made a little bit of an online dashboard for that now, and that will basically spit out how much sodium you need an hour. So I've worked with athletes where we've put that in. It's like they've done like races which are 10 hours, and it's basically saying you don't need any additional sodium. So it can actually go that low. And those athletes have gone out, not taken any, won the race. So for me, I've seen it quite a lot. And again, as an example, last year when I won UTMB with Ruth and Tom, that took those 20 hours each. Like, I didn't put any additional electrolytes in at all. Not because we didn't need electrolytes, but actually, most nutrition products now have got so much sodium in anyway that they were probably both on around about 600 to 700 milligrams of sodium per hour without even trying. And then when I looked at their sodium sweat rates, they were only roughly about 300 milligrams an hour. So again, what we'd expect to see in elites and amateurs, sweat sodium concentrations will change a lot, but they can be completely different depending on the conditions you're performing in, how much heat adaptation you've done, training status, how much you've eaten before at your last meal, the intensity you're running at as well. So again, that concentration is going to change quite a lot, but certainly getting acclimatized to like the environmental conditions will start to drive that down. So like saying elites, I quite often see like quite low sodium sweat rates, the point where I don't really think about it. And again, as I said before, like sodium isn't going to help with like electrolytes aren't going to help with absorption. Like if they help with anything in terms of hydration, they'll help with retaining fluid because it's going to increase that plasma osmolality. So again, that's going to increase that gradient. It's going to hold on to that water a little bit more. You know, whether this is effective in like during performance is another thing. Sodium might well be more important taking after an event where we're trying to rehydrate a lot in terms of that recovery. So, you know, adding electrolytes and sodium to a drink there could be important, or we just take a meal that's got quite a lot of salt in it already, it'll do exactly the same thing. So again, people are sort of selling electrolytes as well in lots of different ways to say you'll be dehydrated without it, which is absolutely nonsense. Otherwise, we'd be all dead by now. You know, we would have dehydrated the species out of existence a long time ago. People are saying it's going to stop cramps. Like again, the literature now suggests that there's no evidence of that at all, and it doesn't. And I always think if electrolytes stopped cramps, then they would be much more expensive. I know people who would spend any amount of money to try and stop cramps in a race. And electrolytes aren't going to be the key to that. And electrolytes, people claim it improves performance. It doesn't. All these things are just completely unjustified. I still give athletes electrolytes in longer races because people are going to lose that sodium and it does need to replace. But like for like, it unlikely doesn't there. Again, on an average ride or run for 1 to 2 hours going out each day, you probably don't need it. Because again, I've looked at over 200 athletes' diaries now, food diaries, from amateurs to elites. And I've only ever seen two people who are taking in the recommended daily amounts of sodium. Most people are taking more than double of that. And for athletes, it doesn't matter too much. And even the World Health Organization says that, like, sodium intakes for athletes, like, at rest doesn't make much difference. if you compare it to someone who's not doing exercise. So we don't really need to worry too much about the health consequences there. But again, people are just getting loads and loads and loads. So there's no reason to pour more on for going for like an easy run or an easy bike ride or whatever it may be.
Yeah, I mean, I have a big conflict of interest with Precision Fuel Hydration being a sponsor, and they have electrolyte products, so I'm not going to comment too much on that. But the one thing that I would say is just that with hyponatremia is something that does, it's not common to have severe consequences, but it does happen. So it's something to think about, at least if you don't have any other products that contain sodium, but to get in a certain amount of sodium.
Yeah, but I think even that with hyponatremia, like even if you take in drinks with electrolytes in, you can still get hyponatremia because it's simply taking on more fluid than what's going out in sweat and urine. So again, it's that over drinking. If sweat sodium was going to stop that, it'd have to be a really high concentration of sweat sodium. If electrolytes were going to stop that, like sodium in your drink, it'd have to be a really high concentration. So again, like, yeah, it's important, but like I think what's more important is simply the amount of fluid that you're taking on rather than the amount of sodium in it. No sodium's going to stop that if you're drinking buckets and buckets and buckets of water.
Yeah. Well, that I can definitely agree with. And also, if you don't drink enough, that it doesn't matter. If you, the little fluid that you consume has the perfect amount of electrolytes, because you still don't get enough fluid in, and that's going to be much more important.
Yeah, exactly. And as I say, like the research goes up to 5 hours. So above 5 hours, so for an Ironman, for example, we're in like an unknown area there. So for me, I always play it on the side of safe and put electrolytes in, regardless of what I may think about that. And again, what I see is like a normal dose of electrolytes. I don't think it really affects performance detrimentally. Ideally, it might even improve performance, but the literature isn't there. But like, I'm happy to go with it if I'm not kind of seeing that it's giving someone gut issues or reducing times or things like that. So I still put sodium in, but I probably wouldn't be worried about like the finer details of it, of whether I'm putting in 700 or 750 milligrams an hour.
No, that I completely agree with. Because it's even the same with fluid, though, that we don't know exact. I mean, we have the 2 to 3% body weight that is more of a, you don't want to go below that. But what we don't know exactly is how your sweat rate changes through an event, unless we're going to weigh ourselves every aid station or something like that, which would actually be really interesting to do. And maybe it has been done in some case studies, but I don't think there's a huge body of literature on that.
Yeah, like the Western States 100 run, a few years back, every year they would put weighing scales on at each of the aid stations there. And they would look at that, and they would use it for research as well. But they ended up taking it, the scales away, because I think athletes would weigh themselves and then completely modify what they were doing for the next leg. So yeah, they thought it was kind of dangerous. Again, from a research perspective, it'd be really interesting.
That's a really interesting example of how more data is not always better. Like, you give the athletes more data and they change what they're doing, and it might, I guess they didn't necessarily show that anything bad happened there, but they at least saw a risk in that. I want to ask as well about the logistics, basically, of how you get your fluid and your carbohydrates in. What are your recommendations there? Do you go fluid separate and carbohydrate in gels, or do you prescribe mixing carbohydrates into drink bottles? What is your preference there?
Complete mix, actually, and a lot of that will be down to the athlete's individual preference as well and what they're comfortable with. Quite often I will see like a mix. Ideally, it's good to kind of to keep up taking on something every 20 minutes or so. Again, there's some really good research out there, but as I said earlier, but it increases like gastric emptying. But also, there's some good research that suggests that by eating regularly every 15 to 20 minutes or so, it can actually increase blood flow back to the gut. So there's a chance that it could reduce GI issues rather than taking like a big bolus each hour as well. And again, the rate that you take food on also has a bearing in terms of like oxidation efficiency and carbohydrate oxidation. So again, if you were going to eat every 5 minutes, that's actually seen to be detrimental, and actually you'll oxidize less of those than you would if you were taking something on like every 20 minutes or every 30 minutes, let's say. So again, for me, like, I'll always kind of balance it. And most of the athletes I work with seem to have naturally gone to this blend where they've got a very high carbohydrate drink in like 500 or 600 milliliters, where it could be 80 to 90 grams of carbs. And then actually another bottle or flask, which would be the same amount of fluid again, but just plain water. So there's almost like this high carb fluid, and then there's a little palate cleanser in there. So they skip between the two, and then they can dial it in and put gels in there as well. So sometimes, and again, if I do a race plan, I won't always say take like 110, 120 grams an hour. There's times when I might see, depending on the terrain of a course, it might be as little as 80 grams or as high as 120 grams at some points. Sometimes I'll back off to let people's guts have a little bit of a rest. You know, I mean, this would be different in course in terms of that course terrain and if it's a hilly course or not and things like that, and like what the athlete's ultimate aims are in there and where pinch points could be in terms of where someone might want to make a break or not or back off. So again, that would obviously change throughout. And then again, that might change hour by hour as well. So sometimes you might just go in with drinks because it's more practical, particularly you know, on the run, or like you might go in with all gels 1 hour, or a little bit of balance of both. Again, what I try and do more than anything is try and not to make the drinks too strong, but put a drink in and then maybe have like one gel an hour on the hour. So you take this gel and then you've got the drink for the rest of the hour, and then the gel and the drink. So again, there's like, from what I see, like, there's probably an optimal way of doing it, but I've tried lots and lots of different combinations and had a lot of like really good international success with all those different combinations. So I think, again, it's more what the athlete's most comfortable with. I would just try and steer away from taking large single boluses at any one time, whether that's fluid or whether it's carbohydrates, and try and measure it out in equal doses every 20 to 30 minutes or so.
Yeah. How would you translate that to the bike of a triathlon, if there's any difference in how you would do that?
Yeah, like with a bike, again, like,
let's assume that you can have basically four bottles on your bike that you start the bike with, and then you can obviously grab fluid from the aid stations, but there you're restricted to what is offered at any given race, which you might not get you're not going to get your exact mix necessarily that you're using from the start of the bike.
Yeah, so reducing it down on the bike, certainly going with what a lot of people do, where it's just fill a bottle up with like really strong carbohydrate mix. So you've got that there. And then like, or do a normal carbohydrate mix, and then even just two bottles of water or electrolytes, simply to water down that really strong mix, and then take some extra gels as backup as well.
Yeah, that's also what I tend to see most athletes doing, and just curious to hear what your thoughts were there. But that makes sense. The one question, this is really only relevant to ultras, I think, rather than triathlons or marathons. But I've done a few 50Ks now, so I'm I wouldn't call myself an ultra runner, but I've been dipping my toes into that world a bit. And I've noticed that sometimes, even in bigger races, well-supported races, and even for somebody running I'm not winning these races by any means, but I'm like towards the front part of the field for sure. But there can still be easily a 90-minute stretch between aid stations, if not 2 hours. I'm trying to remember if I've had that happen. It probably has happened in some of those races. And I often see athletes coming in at the aid station and just leaving with 500 milliliters of water and not even to seem to barely have anything in their packs, in their vests. And I feel like I'm carrying all sorts of things. So I'm not sure if I'm doing anything wrong there because I'm coming in with drinking a full 500 mils at the aid station if I know that there's going to be a long while, and then going off with 1,000 mil in two bottles, if not 1,500 if it's hot. So, well, yeah, what's your take on that? I mean, I should add for context that I do have a higher sweat rate, but I wouldn't say it's extreme either. Like, it might be closer to 2, depending on the conditions, 2 liters an hour in hot conditions, but not probably not over 2 liters at that intensity. So,
yeah, and I think this is the thing. Like, there's certain things like this in terms of individuality that defies explanation. So, as an example, sort of similar to that on the opposite end, I did a trail marathon with my wife a couple of weeks ago, and we didn't stop at any aid stations. And we did, that was like 3.5 hours. And at the end, when I looked at her like soft flash she was carrying, she'd not even drank coffee. So she'd not even drank 250 mil that whole time. So I just think there's probably two things in there. Some people's sweat rates just aren't as high. So again, if you've got a high sweat rate, on one hand, you're good, because again, many elites have a high sweat rate because that's going to help with thermoregulation. But obviously your hydration needs are going to go up at the same time. And then the people who are potentially drinking less are simply people who might be able to deal with greater amounts of dehydration. So again, it might be some people drop off a cliff at 2% and like they're trying to find the next drink from anywhere. And some people are just be able to tolerate and carry on. So again, it's different. And I see it quite a lot. And as I said at the start, I'll get people in the lab who have won major competitions on like 500 mil an hour. When you think your sweat rate must surely be higher than this. So again, there's those differences in there, which for a lot of people, kind of going right back to the start, is going back to thinking about what you feel is and what you're comfortable is. If you're thirsty and you feel that you need to take on X amount of water, then actually, like, that's probably what your body's asking for. And the fact that you become dehydrated, that blood osmolality is increased. That's that blood sodium concentration, and that osmotic signal would be saying, "Look, drink. You know, I need more plasma volume." So again, that's what's going to be driving that. So on one hand, it's unfortunate, but on the other hand, just think you'll probably never overheat.
Yeah, that's a good point. It's really interesting though, because at least if you're talking about races where you're lucky and the temperature doesn't get very high, then somebody with a low sweat rate, maybe even low sweat sodium concentration, would have a bit of a natural advantage. At least, maybe the sodium concentration less important, but the sweat rate in itself, if you don't need thermoregulation to the same degree given the environmental conditions, then that's going to be an advantage. But you are right that in hot races, then that's also helping you. So there's a balance there.
Yeah, and that's probably also why there's a bit of a buzz at the moment around taurine. There's a few taurine studies going, but there's quite a long history of literature around taurine. I think there's a bit of a buzz at the moment because we're approaching summer, and we know, like in a lot of places, particularly in Europe, it's being already really hot. So again, people are looking for methods to improve thermoregulation. So taurine has been seen that, you take dose of taurine and that will essentially reduce that internal thermometer. So you will actually start to sweat at a lower temperature, at a lower core temperature, and potentially your sweat rate might increase as well. So again, there's all these kind of different things going into that. But when I've worked with athletes, they always say, "Oh, well, actually, it's great because it'll help with thermoregulation, but I'm already a high sweater, so will that just make me sweat even more? And then it means my hydration needs are going to go up even more, which I could risk dehydration and a drop in performance at that point as well. So there's always going to be those two sides to it.
Yeah. And from my perspective, I do think that in long races, for me at least, I'm not ready to extrapolate the lab data into exactly what's going on, especially given the changes in temperature and environmental conditions throughout the whole day. Of even in an Ironman, lots of athletes start in the morning, it's fairly cool, hot weather throughout the day, and then it cools down again in the evening when they're finishing the marathon, or even at midnight or 1 o'clock when the finish line closes, depending on the race start. So I think that the point there being that you can have all of these numbers and this data as a starting point, but then there are still perhaps changes and modifications you need to make based on your experience, both in training, but especially in past races, knowing that's definitely what the reason that my anecdote there with filling up multiple bottles at the aid stations and seeing people pass me in aid stations when they barely filled up any bottle came from experience of in the past maybe only filling up one bottle and then realizing that, well, I really suffer when I get dehydrated, so I'd better take my time and get this fluid with me regardless of what anybody else is doing.
Yeah, exactly. And I'd say part of the message within that as well is like what's really important is to make sure that you're starting in a well hydrated state, like not over hydrated. Some people will consume lots and lots of fluid and again, they'll just get peed out before the race, but just making sure that like you've drank enough the day before and you've drank enough in the morning as well. So again, in the morning before the race, just even drinking things like orange juice, like smooth orange juice or like clear apple juice. So you're going to hydrate, but also you're going to get carbohydrates through that. Or if you want to carbohydrate load even more, just drinking a sports drink as well.
Yep. Yeah, great points. Let's move into some listener questions to make sure that we get through those. We might have a couple that I didn't send you because they came in a bit later. And apologies to anybody if I missed some, but I think that I'll try to skip the ones that we've already covered through our discussion so far. But the first one that I'll read here is from Sub BR Satch, who is asking, any meaningful value in restricting carbs for 1 to 2 hour endurance rides for somebody training less than 10 hours per week? So we're talking about sort of glycogen restricted training or
it depends on what the outcome is and what that overall week is. I mean, if it's just an easy 1 to 2 hour ride, it's likely that you don't need to take on anything at all. So again, like it kind of goes back to that truth or false thing we sort of did at the start. But like for me, like people talk about fueling and it's all about like during training or it's during races. But for me, the important part of fueling is what you're doing with your everyday diet. So ideally, if you're training for like just an easy ride, easy run for 1 to 2 hours, then hopefully you're taking on enough carbohydrates in your diet that you're going to increase those glycogen stores. So you've got enough glycogen in your system to cover that. So again, that should never really be a problem. It's only if you're starting to ramp up training or you're doing long training or you're doing intense training where you're going to need even more, or, you know, you're trying to restrict carbohydrates through your diet just rather than just within that training session. There's another thing around that as well is, it's do we know that we're doing low glycogen training? So people talk about fasted training, but fasted training for most people is simply not having breakfast. And actually, the day before, they've had rice and they've had pasta and they've had bread. So the muscles are full of glycogen. The liver glycogen might just be potentially 30 to 40% depleted, but actually they've got plenty of fuel stores in there. It's just they've not had breakfast. So again, it depends what we're trying to do, what kind of stimulus we're trying to create through that. Again, like for me, if I was to go out on my bike now and it was a 2 hour ride, like there's a chance I might not take anything. Where I live is really hilly. To get in and out of my village, I need to cover 1,000 meters. So it's always going to be a tough ride. So if I leave that, I might take on a single gel or a chew at some point, or I might put something in my drink, but again, it'd only be a kind of a second thought just in case.
Yeah. There's that side of the sort of the story that you might not need it, but like if we really go to the question of is there any value, like are that because that was also trendy, I would say 6, 7, 8 years ago, the whole glycogen depleted training. And yes, you're right, fasted training is not necessarily glycogen depleted, but what are your takes on that? Because I've done proper glycogen depleted training, high intensity intervals in the evening, no carbs after that, and then a long ride with very limited carbs in the morning. I've done that for long blocks of training, not every ride obviously, but one per week or so. And so I kind of have some experience with that, and I have my thoughts, but I'm curious to hear your thoughts on that, if that's something that could have any value.
I'm sort of on the fence about this one a bit, but because a lot, it depends, like in amateur athletes, actually, some of that's shown to increase fat adaptation, whereas in elites, not so much. So for me, I think, again, if someone's doing like Ironman or Ultra, from my experience, a lot of people are underfueling in their diet anyway. So if you're, let's say, like your last listener, like trains 10 hours a week, let's say they move that up, we had a race coming up and then they went up to like 15 hours a week. So a lot of that training might go on in the week and then they've got a longer ride or a lot longer run at the weekend, and that could be back to backs over Saturday and Sunday. If they're not eating enough carbs in the week, which would be certainly eating more than a normal person would eat in terms of breakfast, lunch, dinner, snacks, things like that, then yeah, they're going to top up those glycogen stores through the week. But by the time they get to a weekend, you know, they won't be fully depleted, but they'll certainly be not full. You know, on that first day, that long session is certainly going to deplete that more. And then by the second day, like, they're certainly going to go into a major glycogen deficit there. That tank's going to be pretty drained. So we know that at the end of that, they're going to finish in a glycogen depleted state, and that's where we'll get the stimulus. So again, it could well be that, like, chronically, if they're doing that a lot over a long period of time, then that's creating that stimulus, because physiologically, you know, we've seen the markers, we've seen the evidence that that does work in terms of things like improving fat oxidation, increasing mitochondrial biogenesis. We've just not seen that come through in terms of the performance data yet. The chance is, I think, that a lot of people are just doing that already without even trying, because most people I see just aren't eating enough carbohydrates to support even a moderate amount of training.
Quick one, for a moderate amount of training, let's say, let's split the difference, 12-13 hours a week of training with a decent amount of intensity. So somebody doing triathlon training where you can do a bit more intensity than if you do running. What is grams per kilogram body weight? Where would you pin that sort of range where people should try to aim for with that training volume?
It depends. I would change it day by day. So again, I periodize it across the week, and it depends on how that structure looked as well. So there's some days I might go in quite light, and there's other days I'd go in a lot. So again, if it was those two back-to-back days on a weekend, let's say, then actually I would, and then let's say we did a 45-minute run on a Thursday and a 45-minute run on a Friday, I would go in heavier on the Thursday and Friday, more than would be needed for a 45-minute run, because actually I'm planning ahead to the Saturday and Sunday. So I'm thinking about fueling then. I'm even thinking, if someone's even higher than that, like, I'd look from the start of the week and how we can fuel there. So again, like, that might well be for a sort of 45-minute run or ride, well, let's say 45 minutes to an hour and a half, the sort of, like, the bottom end of that is about 5 grams per kilogram of body weight per day. So I'd definitely start to go up and maybe go to 6 or 7. So it's above what they need for those days. But like I say, I'm planning ahead for my weekend. And then when it got to the weekend, I would certainly go up a little bit more. So on the Saturday, I would probably go anywhere to 8 and 10. Hmm. And then on the Sunday, it depends what I'm doing on the Monday then as well. So I might start to fill in a little bit more with more protein there.
Yeah. And that's, to be clear, because I'm not sure I was clear about that for the listeners, grams of carbs per kilogram body weight per day total. So it's not training nutrition, but oral nutrition. Let's do the next listener question here from Svenwell GBG1. What changes with age? And I assume that we talk about nutrition, hydration, those things.
Well, what changed with age? So in terms of that nutrition, not as much really. And again, there's potentially certain changes in terms of gender as well. There could be different effects between men and women. Again, there's some research around that, but there's nothing that strong yet. And that's not my specific area. What I would say is, as an athlete gets older, particularly into the 60s and certainly into the 70s, we become more anabolic resistant. So in terms of protein needs, whereas someone who's 20 could quite easily get a really good stimulus off 20 grams of protein in a meal, it would take double for someone who's older. Your muscle is just more resistant to it. So ideally for someone of an older age who would need more protein and more protein at each sitting. The issue is, as we get older, actually, particularly when we get into the 60s and 70s, appetite can start to go down as well. So we're trying to eat more protein, as our appetites are changing, and protein will make us full. So that can become really difficult. So again, putting in more protein shakes and easier ways to get protein in as well with that. As for kind of carbohydrates and fueling, during a workout, that doesn't really change too much.
Yep. Let's do a few more and let's try to keep them really quick fire so we don't make this episode too long. The next one is from, these names, handles are so hard. Cuff Bertol Good. Thoughts on honey as a gel?
But some good research came out from Liverpool John Moores University a couple of years ago. Honey's good, but I use honey only ever in terms of gut training, because honey is high fructose. And so for some people, they don't have a really good reaction to fructose. I think it's something about, I'm sure I read it somewhere, 11% of people, apologies if I've got that number wrong, but yeah, some people don't respond too well to fructose. So you can actually train the gut up on fructose. So I'll give people more honey to start training the gut on fructose. So you can use it as a carb, and it's probably going to be, it's not as going to be good as glucose or maltodextrin, but certainly you can do it. I wouldn't be trying to hit 120 grams an hour on just honey though, but as something else to put in there is good. And there's a really good research to show that you put honey on your breakfast, that fructose in it will, it gets first pass through the liver, so it'll help to top up liver glycogen faster as well.
Yeah. And then from Renee Kylie, the better half of good friend of the show, Aril Tvaitan, if trying to specifically improve LT1, should an athlete limit carb intake during workouts? I guess this one is a bit the same as we already talked about, but if...
Yeah, I definitely say no, it's not going to have any effect on LT1. In fact, if you want to improve LT1, I would ensure that you dial in your fueling for every workout to make sure that you're... Again, we've got this balance. You can go into a workout and try and find a stimulus by underfueling it, but actually the best stimulus you're ever going to find in any workouts is if you can maximize everything in that workout and recover well to the next one. And that means fueling optimally for that.
Yep. Ruslan Niges, how will endurance capacity indicators change in an individual using semaglutide?
Yeah, so weight loss drugs. You're probably not going to see anything different apart from, again, it might have a knock-on effect of performance, but that knock-on effect might well be simply through that weight loss. But again, this is something for a whole podcast and it's quite a controversial topic. But what you're going to certainly find is you might see less train adaptation because you're probably going to be underfueling more. So you're just not going to get reach those same maximal rates on any of your training sessions, and you're going to fatigue earlier. So it could be difficult. But at the same time, it depends on that individual athlete. I've seen a lot of athletes recently where their weight, particularly for obese, is a barrier to entry to the sport, and they've taken weight loss drugs and actually they've been able to take part in sports already, and that's, you know, that's improved their overall health, but also it's improved the quality of their lives and the confidence and how they think about themselves. So again, it depends on that individual. Like, I wouldn't say if someone thinks that they need to shave off a few kilos to perform better, that's probably not the way I would do it. I would do it like longer and more structured, so you're still making the most of those training sessions, but you're just taking a little bit off at a time. That's if you do need to lose weight.
That's a follow-up question to you then on this. Is that in the world of elite ultra running, which is where you're the most active with professional athletes, I guess, how important is weight there? Is that something that is a focus of a lot of athletes, or is it not?
Less and less, I would say. I've seen weight creeping up a little bit, particularly now that people are much more aware of the literature around like REDS and things like that. So people understand that, yeah, if you're not eating enough and you're too light, then actually chances of getting injured will increase, particularly like long-term bone injuries. I just feel some people still think about weight, but there's not the fixation there was on weight that there used to be. And particularly in ultras, when people are trying to get a little bit lighter to run up hills, it just feels that it's not there. But when I do DEXA scans with a lot of athletes, I've noticed that overall body fat has gone down. But I think that's also in part because people have become leaner, not necessarily through actively trying to lose weight, but simply hitting the gym more and doing a lot of resistance exercise and a lot of resistance work around that. So people are coming in, from what I'm seeing now, with a bit more pumped, like more muscular in terms of leanness there, rather than just trying to cut out all fat completely and not do any resistance exercise.
Yeah. And I know you collaborate with Scott Johnston, is that the fair to say, right? He's also a past guest on the podcast, and he's pretty big on the strength work as a foundational part of that, from my understanding anyway.
Yeah, exactly. So his big thing is like that is muscular endurance. And again, on like particularly on like long ultras, that muscular breakdown, particularly from like eccentric loading going downhill, you know, that's really gonna take its toll on fatigue later in the race, and that's gonna be the cause of decline in economy and running, muscular pain, things like that. So those levels of fatigue, what Scott's trying to do is, you know, try and create that stimulus in training as much as possible to protect the muscle. So it reduces those levels of fatigue, particularly in the downhill work later in a race.
Yep. Let's do one more and then we'll start to wrap up. So this one is from CW Team Vegan, who asks, I often bloat up and retain lots of water. Health checked, all good. Mistakes, ? How to lose, not get it.
Okay, not, yeah. So
loading and, yeah.
Yeah, so I'd say the answer is in the title of that person, vegan. This is not me having a go at vegans, but again, when I see vegan diets, and I was vegan I was vegetarian for like 30 years and vegan for a big chunk of that. But again, a lot of my diet was, lentils and chickpeas and lots of beans, and actually a really nice diet, but a lot full of fiber. And for a few years, I was getting gut issues similar to that. And then I looked at my diet and I changed it, and all those gut issues went. And I think with this athlete, it's more likely the fact that a big portion of their diet is made up through fibers, particularly those, those fibers which are going to get into the gut and start to ferment. So that's where that bloating will come from. 99% confident on that. So again,
is there a thing that can be done if they want to remain vegan? What can they do within that constraint?
Oh yeah, for sure. And again, like what I would say is, don't go changing your diet because of that, but just look at the timing a little bit differently. So what are they having for breakfast? What are they having for dinner? And again, if you are eating a lot of lentils and beans, maybe put those directly after your training session. So you've got a longer time between that and the next session. And then again, review that overall like intake of healthy foods that someone's taking. Like even things like for taking a lot of porridge oats at breakfast, again, there's a little bit more fat in there, there's a little bit more protein in there, there's more fiber. That can certainly create bloating with some people.
Yeah, yeah. All right. Well, I know you're working on a study at the moment and you were potentially interested in recruiting some people for some interesting experiments. So do you want to share a bit about that and see if you can hook somebody into that?
Yeah, great. Thanks for promotion. Yeah, so we've got a study coming up starting July 2026, which will be based in the laboratories at Leeds Beckett University. And that is direct 90 versus 120 gram study. So we're looking at things like oxidation rate. So we'll use like stable isotopes with that. We'll do like submax, max tests, so VO2 max, lactate threshold, DEXA scans. The only downside is you'll have to come into lab 3 times and on 2 of those occasions, run for 7 hours on a treadmill. So again, some people might go for that, some people might not. We do get quite a lot of people coming through, but it's roughly about £3,500 worth of testing, which is probably about just over €4,000. So you'll get a really, really good overview of an understanding of what your peak oxidation rates are. So you'll get to dial like that in for whatever race you've coming up. Again, trying to get like athletes who can work at a good intensity as well, and who can maintain like a good performance over that time. But again, it's not cycling, it's all running. So again, it's more for those athletes who are potentially doing Ironman, but also working in ultra marathon as well.
Yeah. Yeah. I want to ask you one final question, by the way, non-sport related. Well, actually there's a little bit of sport in it, which is, can you give one sport related recommendation and one non-sport related recommendation for people visiting Leeds or the surrounding regions?
For Leeds, what I would say is, Leeds and Yorkshire in particular, it's like really strong on triathlon. So we've got the Brownlees from here. It's great for that. So again, if I was going where I live on the Yorkshire Dales, is great for running. So I would say to anyone, come and try fell running. So it's basically like running really hard up and down hills, going off path. And again, it's very unique to the north of England. It's tough. You'll see some great athletes in there that, could be world class, but, they just turn up for races and go home at the end of it. Amazing cycling as well. The Tour de France went through my village. So we've got some classic climbs. Like non-sports activities. I'd say there's a really, really good coastline here. But actually, particularly in Leeds, there's a really good music scene as well. So you can kind of get some gigs going on there. Like history-wise, there's around Yorkshire, there's like quite a lot of castles, things like that. So there's some pretty good places to visit. And then again, if you don't want to stay there, you can jump on a train an hour away. It's my hometown of Manchester. And that's good for a night out.
Very nice, yeah. You might run into the Brownlees on one of those fell races if you do them, because at least it used to be their bread and butter, but I think Alistair is still doing some one every once in a while. There's also Ironman Leeds now. I just checked. It's available on Ruvi if people want to check it out. Ruvi is a partner of the podcast and you can ride a lot of Ironman and Ironman 73 courses there, Leeds being one of them. I guess that wraps us up for today. Just a couple of things. First of all, any links that we'll put in today's episode will be on scientifictriathlon.com/TTS706. Secondly, remember to check out the coaching and training plans that we offer at Scientific Triathlon. If you're preparing for races, if you have done races this year and they didn't go as well as you hoped, then try to get some professional help would be probably the first and best protocol. And remember to check out the episode description as well for the discount codes for our sponsors, Ruvi, Effortless Swimming and Precision Fuel Hydration. And see what they have to offer there. All the information in the episode description. And Paul, thank you so much for coming on the show. It was really great to chat to you.
Excellent. Thanks for the invite.